The Bhagavad Gita, or Song of God, stands as perhaps humanity's most profound spiritual dialogue ever recorded. This 700-verse Sanskrit text has captured minds across cultures and centuries, from Emerson and Thoreau to Gandhi and Einstein. When J. Robert Oppenheimer witnessed the first atomic bomb test, he famously quoted from the Gita, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." What makes this ancient text so universally resonant? Set against the backdrop of an impending war, the Gita captures a moment of existential crisis that mirrors our own inner battles. As Arjuna faces his moral dilemma on the battlefield, Krishna reveals timeless wisdom about duty, purpose, and the nature of reality itself. Today, tech leaders in Silicon Valley keep copies on their desks. Spiritual seekers across traditions study its verses, and its practical philosophy continues to offer guidance in our complex modern world. The Bhagavad Gita unfolds at a pivotal moment in the Mahabharata, India's monumental epic that's 7 times longer than the Iliad and Odyssey combined. 2 cousin groups, the virtuous Pandavas and the wicked Kauravas, have assembled their armies on the sacred field of Kurukshetra, ready for a war that will determine the future of the kingdom. The Pandavas, led by the righteous Yudhishthira, represent Dharma, virtue, and cosmic order. Having been cheated out of their kingdom and endured 13 years of exile, they now seek to reclaim what is rightfully theirs. The Kauravas, led by the jealous and greedy Duryodhana, embody adharma, unrighteousness. When both sides sought Krishna's help in the impending war, he offered a choice. One side could have his entire army, while the other could have Krishna himself, though he would not wield any weapons. Duryodhana eagerly chose Krishna's mighty army, while Arjuna wisely selected Krishna himself as his charioteer. As the battle is about to begin, Arjuna asks Krishna to position his chariot between the two armies so he can see who he must fight. Looking across the battlefield, Arjuna recognizes his beloved teachers, relatives, and friends in the opposing army. A crisis of conscience overwhelms him. How can he kill those he loves and respects? He drops his bow and declares he would rather die than slay his kinsmen. This moment of moral paralysis creates the perfect opening for Krishna to impart profound spiritual wisdom. What follows is not merely advice for Arjuna's immediate predicament, but a comprehensive philosophy for living that addresses the eternal questions of existence. Who am I? What is my purpose? How should I live? What happens after death? The genius of the Gita lies in how it transforms a specific historical moment into a universal allegory. Kurukshetra becomes the field of Dharma, the battlefield of righteousness within each human heart. Arjuna represents the human soul struggling with moral dilemmas, while Krishna symbolizes divine wisdom guiding us through life's most challenging decisions. Krishna begins his teachings by addressing Arjuna's immediate grief. Rather than offering mere consolation, he reveals a profound truth about the nature of existence. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. This introduces one of the Gita's central concepts, the immortality of the Atman, soul. Krishna explains that what we call death is merely the soul changing bodies, like discarding worn-out garments for new ones. The soul is neither born, nor does it ever die, nor, having once existed, does it ever cease to be. The soul is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. It is not slain when the body is slain. This teaching directly addresses Arjuna's anguish over killing his relatives. Krishna explains that no one can truly kill or be killed. What appears as death is merely a transformation. The essential self remains untouched by physical changes. This doesn't mean we should be callous about life, but rather understand its deeper nature. The Gita's view of the soul differs fundamentally from both materialist philosophies that deny any existence beyond the physical body and certain religious views that see the soul as created at birth. Instead, it presents the Atman as eternal, without beginning or end, a fragment of the divine that journeys through multiple lifetimes. Krishna uses this understanding to address Arjuna's immediate duty as a warrior. Since the soul is immortal, Arjuna need not grieve for those who will die in battle. Moreover, as a kshatriya, warrior, fighting for righteousness is his dharma, duty according to his nature and position. To abandon this duty out of attachment would bring dishonor and create negative karma. This teaching about the immortal self serves as the foundation for everything that follows. Only by understanding our eternal nature can we approach life's challenges with proper perspective. When we identify with the changeless Atman rather than the temporary body, we gain the equanimity to act without being overwhelmed by fear or attachment to outcomes. Having established the immortality of the soul, Krishna introduces Karma Yoga, the path of selfless action. This revolutionary concept addresses a fundamental human dilemma. How can we live actively in the world without becoming entangled in its web of desire and attachment? Krishna's answer is profound yet practical. You have the right to perform your prescribed duties, but you are not entitled to the fruits of your actions. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities, nor be attached to inaction. This teaching directly contrasts two common extremes: frantic action driven by desire for results, and withdrawal from action out of fear or indifference. Instead, Krishna charts a middle path where action is performed as sacred duty, with the results offered to the divine. The genius of Karma Yoga lies in its psychological insight. Human suffering largely stems from attachment to outcomes. We become anxious when results are uncertain, disappointed when they fall short of expectations, and insatiable when they meet our desires but create new ones. By focusing on the action itself rather than its fruits, we find freedom from this emotional roller coaster. Krishna illustrates this principle through the metaphor of a lotus leaf, which remains in water but is never wetted by it. Similarly, the Karma Yogi lives and acts in the world but remains untouched by its entanglements. This doesn't mean becoming cold or detached from life, but rather developing a higher attachment to the divine that puts worldly attachments in perspective. The practical application of Karma Yoga involves seeing all work as sacred offering. Whether changing diapers, solving engineering problems, or governing a nation, every action becomes yoga when performed with skill, attention, and an attitude of service. This transforms not just the quality of our work, but our entire relationship with life. Krishna emphasizes that even enlightened beings should continue to act for the welfare of the world. He cites the example of King Janaka, who, despite being self-realized, continued to perform his royal duties to set an example for others. This counters the misconception that spiritual advancement requires withdrawal from worldly responsibilities. Perhaps most revolutionary is the Gita's assertion that Karma Yoga leads to the same destination as paths of knowledge or meditation, but with the advantage of being accessible to everyone. While not everyone can retreat to forests or mountains for contemplation, everyone can transform their daily work into spiritual practice through the alchemy of selfless action. To help Arjuna understand why people behave differently and how to navigate the material world, Krishna introduces the concept of the three gunas, fundamental qualities that constitute material nature. These three modes, sattva, goodness, rajas, passion, and tamas, influence everything from food preferences to spiritual practices. Sattva is characterized by light, clarity, and harmony. It brings wisdom, peace, and happiness that may seem like poison at first, but is like nectar in the end. People influenced by sattva are drawn to pure foods, truthful speech, and actions that contribute to long-term well-being rather than immediate gratification. Their worship is serene, their charity given without expectation, and their knowledge illuminating. Rajas manifests as energy, desire, and attachment. It creates restlessness, ambition, and endless striving. Those dominated by Rajas experience happiness that is like nectar at first, but poison in the end, as their achievements never satisfy their growing desires. They prefer spicy, bitter foods, speak words that excite or disturb others, and perform actions driven by ego and the desire for recognition. Tamas embodies darkness, inertia, and delusion. It produces laziness, confusion, and negligence. People under its influence prefer stale or impure foods, speak hurtfully or meaninglessly, and either avoid action entirely or act destructively. Their worship involves empty rituals, their charity given reluctantly or to unworthy recipients, and their knowledge limited to small material concerns. Krishna explains that these modes constantly compete for dominance within us, creating our changing mental states. One moment we might feel peaceful and clear, sattva, the next ambitious and restless, rajas, and later lethargic and confused, tamas. Understanding this fluctuation helps us become more self-aware and intentional about cultivating higher qualities. The gunas also explain why different spiritual paths appeal to different people. Those in tamas might be drawn to superstitious practices or worship of ghosts and spirits. Those in rajas often worship for material gain or power. Those in sattva worship with pure devotion, seeking wisdom and harmony. Most importantly, Krishna reveals that ultimate liberation comes from transcending all three gunas, even sattva. While sattva is the highest mode and should be cultivated, it still binds one to material existence through attachment to happiness and knowledge. True freedom comes from identifying with the transcendental consciousness beyond the modes of nature. This teaching offers profound psychological insight. By understanding which guna is influencing us at any moment, we can make conscious choices rather than being driven by unconscious conditioning. When feeling tamasic, we can choose activities that increase rajas or sattva. When feeling rajasic, we can channel that energy towards sattvic pursuits. Gradually, we develop the ability to witness the play of gunas without being controlled by them. In one of the Gita's most dramatic moments, Arjuna asks to see Krishna's universal form, his true divine nature beyond the human appearance he had assumed. What follows is a breathtaking vision that transcends ordinary perception and reveals the cosmic dimensions of divinity. Krishna grants Arjuna divine sight, as no physical eyes could bear such a vision. Suddenly, Arjuna beholds a form of infinite wonder, countless mouths, eyes, and divine ornaments radiating the brilliance of 1,000 suns. Within this cosmic body, Arjuna sees all beings and worlds contained in one place, all gods and celestial beings, and the entire universe in its past, present, and future states. The vision quickly shifts from wonder to terror as Arjuna witnesses all beings rushing into Krishna's many mouths like moths into fire. Krishna reveals himself as all-devouring time, the force that ultimately consumes everything. I am mighty time, the source of destruction that comes forth to annihilate the worlds, he declares. Even without your participation, all the warriors standing arrayed in the opposing armies shall cease to exist. Trembling with fear, Arjuna begs Krishna to return to his familiar four-armed form and then to his gentle human appearance. When Krishna complies, Arjuna expresses relief, having glimpsed a reality too overwhelming for human comprehension. This episode serves multiple purposes in the narrative. First, it establishes Krishna's divine identity beyond any doubt. Second, it places Arjuna's immediate battlefield dilemma in cosmic perspective. The warriors are already dead in the eyes of eternal time, with Arjuna merely serving as an instrument of divine will. Third, it reveals different dimensions of the divine, from the intimate personal form that devotees can love to the cosmic manifestation that transcends all human categories. Perhaps most significantly, the vision challenges our limited perception of reality. What we see with ordinary eyes is just a fragment of what exists. The universe is vaster, more interconnected, and more mysterious than our everyday consciousness can grasp. This humbling realization opens us to deeper dimensions of existence beyond our ego's narrow concerns. Yet the episode also affirms the value of human-scale spirituality. After witnessing the cosmic form, Arjuna prefers Krishna's personal form, suggesting that while God's infinite nature transcends comprehension, divine love manifests most meaningfully in relationships we can understand and reciprocate. While the Gita explores multiple spiritual paths, Krishna ultimately reveals devotion, bhakti, as the supreme approach to the divine. Those who fix their minds on me, worship me with unwavering devotion, and are always absorbed in me, I consider them to be the best yogis, he declares. This emphasis on devotion might seem surprising in a text that begins with philosophical discussions about the nature of reality. Yet Krishna explains that while knowledge of the Absolute is valuable, it remains incomplete without love. The intellect can understand God as an abstract principle, but only the heart can know God as a living presence. Krishna describes devotees who are dear to him, those who are compassionate to all beings, friendly, free from possessiveness, even-minded in pleasure and pain, forgiving, content, and steadfast in devotion. These qualities reveal that true devotion isn't just emotional fervor, but a transformation of character that aligns with divine values. The path of devotion makes spiritual life accessible to everyone. While intellectual knowledge requires education and meditation demands specific conditions, devotion can be practiced by anyone, anywhere. If you cannot practice yoga or work for me, then just offer everything to me, Krishna advises. Even if you cannot do this, then surrender to me and renounce the fruits of all actions. Krishna promises special care for his devotees. Those who worship me, thinking solely of me, those ever united in devotion, I provide what they lack and preserve what they have. This assurance of divine support contrasts with paths that rely solely on self-effort. While the devotee must make sincere effort, they ultimately depend on grace rather than personal achievement. The Gita's vision of devotion isn't blind faith or mere ritualism. It's an intelligent love that recognizes the divine as the source, sustainer, and ultimate reality of existence. It involves seeing everything in relation to God, offering all actions as service, seeing all beings as divine fragments, and recognizing all experiences as opportunities for spiritual growth. Krishna reveals that devotion culminates in a love that transcends even the desire for liberation. The mature devotee doesn't serve God to gain heaven or avoid hell, but loves for love's sake alone. This pure devotion creates a relationship where the soul finds its natural position as an eternal servant of the divine, not in subservience, but in the joyful expression of its true nature. To help Arjuna understand the relationship between the material world and consciousness, Krishna introduces the concepts of the field, kshetra, and the knower of the field. This elegant metaphor illuminates the interaction between matter and spirit that constitutes our existence. The field comprises the physical body, mind, intellect, ego, senses, sense objects, desires, happiness, distress, essentially everything that makes up our material experience. Just as a farmer works with a field, planting seeds and reaping harvests, consciousness interacts with this field of experience, sowing actions and reaping their consequences. The knower of the field is the conscious self, the awareness that perceives and experiences the field but remains distinct from it. This consciousness is not produced by material elements, but is a fundamental reality in itself. While modern science often struggles to explain how consciousness emerges from matter, the Gita presents consciousness as primary, an eternal principle that animates matter rather than arising from it. Krishna explains that while each individual soul knows only its own field, and that imperfectly, he, as the Supreme Soul, knows all fields. This introduces a subtle distinction between the individual consciousness and the supreme consciousness. Both are knowers of the field, but with different capacities and perspectives. The field undergoes constant transformation. Bodies age, minds develop new thoughts, circumstances change, while the knower remains constant, witnessing these changes without being changed by them. Understanding this distinction is essential for spiritual development. As long as we identify with the changing field, thinking, "I am this body," or "I am my thoughts," we remain bound to material nature's cycles of pleasure and pain. Krishna describes 20 qualities that help purify the field and reveal the knower more clearly, including humility, nonviolence, forgiveness, straightforwardness, service to teachers, cleanliness, steadfastness, and self-control. These virtues aren't arbitrary moral rules, but practical tools that clarify perception and reduce the ego's distortions. This teaching has profound practical implications. When we identify with the body-mind complex, we become overwhelmed by its changes and demands. When we recognize ourselves as the conscious witness, we gain perspective and freedom. This doesn't mean ignoring the field. We still care for the body, train the mind, and fulfill responsibilities, but we do so with the wisdom that these elements are instruments rather than our essential identity. The field-knower framework also resolves the apparent contradiction between determinism and free will. The field operates according to material laws and past conditioning, creating patterns that seem deterministic. Yet the knower retains the capacity for awareness and choice, the ability to witness these patterns and gradually redirect them through conscious intention. After 18 chapters of profound teachings, Krishna reveals what he calls the most confidential knowledge of all, complete surrender to the divine. Abandon all varieties of dharma, religious duties, and simply surrender unto me alone, he tells Arjuna. I shall liberate you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. This culminating instruction might seem to contradict earlier teachings about performing one's duties. However, it actually transcends them. The earlier emphasis on duty was necessary to overcome Arjuna's initial reluctance to act. Now that he understands action in the context of devotion, Krishna can reveal the deeper principle that all religious practices ultimately aim at complete surrender to God. This surrender, sharanagati, isn't passive resignation, but active alignment with divine will. It means recognizing that we are not independent actors, but eternal parts of the Supreme. Our attempts to control life through our limited intelligence create suffering, while surrendering to divine guidance brings freedom and fulfillment. Krishna acknowledges that this path of complete surrender isn't for everyone. This instruction should never be explained to those who are not austere or devoted, he cautions. Some people need the structure of rules and practices before they can understand the essence of spirituality. Premature abandonment of religious duties without genuine surrender leads to moral confusion rather than liberation. For those ready to receive it, this teaching resolves the tension between effort and grace. While spiritual practices are necessary, they ultimately succeed not through personal achievement, but through divine mercy. The soul's surrender creates the receptivity through which grace can flow. Krishna assures Arjuna that this surrender liberates one from all sinful reactions. This doesn't mean license to act immorally, but rather that past karma loses its binding power when one lives in divine consciousness. Actions performed in the spirit of surrender create no new karmic bonds, as they're not done from ego or desire. The image of surrender beautifully captures the essence of spiritual life. Just as a river surrenders to the ocean, losing its separate identity yet finding fulfillment in union with something greater, the soul finds its perfection in loving surrender to the divine. This isn't self-annihilation, but self-completion, the part recognizing its relationship to the whole. Krishna's promise, "Do not fear," addresses the deepest human anxiety, that we must secure our own existence through constant struggle. Surrender offers an alternative to this exhausting effort, the discovery that we are already held in existence by a power greater than ourselves, needing only to recognize and align with it. The Bhagavad Gita's enduring power lies in its ability to speak to every generation anew. Its teachings transcend the specific battlefield context to address the universal human condition. In our modern world of complexity, distraction, and moral ambiguity, the Gita offers timeless wisdom for navigating life's challenges. At its heart, the Gita presents a comprehensive vision of human fulfillment. While contemporary society often reduces success to wealth, status, or pleasure, the Gita offers a more profound understanding that true fulfillment comes from living in harmony with our deeper nature and the cosmic order. This doesn't require withdrawing from society, but engaging with it from a place of wisdom, compassion, and devotion. The Gita's teaching on karma yoga speaks directly to our modern work culture. In an age of burnout, where people are defined by productivity and consumed by results, Krishna's instruction to perform your duty without attachment to success or failure offers liberation from the anxiety that plagues even the most successful professionals. Work becomes not just a means to an end, but a form of meditation and offering. Similarly, the Gita's exploration of the three gunas provides a framework for understanding the psychological forces that drive behavior, both individually and collectively. In a world of information overload, consumer culture, and political polarization, recognizing how the modes of passion and ignorance influence decision-making helps us make more conscious choices aligned with wisdom rather than impulse. Perhaps most importantly, the Gita offers a path beyond the materialism that dominates modern thinking, without rejection of the material world. It presents a vision where matter and spirit, science and spirituality, action and contemplation are integrated rather than opposed. This holistic perspective is increasingly relevant as humanity faces complex challenges that cannot be solved through fragmented approaches. The Gita's emphasis on devotion also speaks to our time's hunger for meaning and connection. In an age of isolation and digital distraction, the practice of seeing the divine in all beings and all experiences offers a way to transform ordinary life into sacred encounter. This isn't about adopting specific religious forms, but cultivating an attitude of reverence, gratitude, and love that infuses daily existence with deeper significance. For those engaged in social and environmental activism, the Gita offers crucial guidance. Its teaching that we have the right to action but not to its fruits helps prevent the burnout and disillusionment that often afflict those working for change. By combining passionate commitment with non-attachment to results, activists can sustain their work without being crushed by apparent failures or seduced by partial successes. The Gita's final teaching of surrender addresses the fundamental anxiety of our control-obsessed culture. In a world where technology promises ever greater mastery over nature and human limitations, the wisdom of recognizing our place within a larger order offers both humility and hope. True security comes not from controlling life, but from aligning with its deeper currents. As Sanjay concludes his narration of the divine dialogue, he declares, "Wherever there is Krishna, the Lord of Yoga, and wherever there is Arjuna, the wielder of the bow, there will certainly be splendor, victory, prosperity, and righteousness." This assurance remains as true today as when it was first spoken on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. When human effort aligns with divine wisdom, the impossible becomes possible, and the eternal dance of cosmic order continues.